effortlessly, toting the sniper along, he took three quick steps toward the rooftop's edge, then hurled the man over. The sniper's terrified scream was cut short a second later by his fatal impact with the ground below. Scourge turned and raced back to the open hatch. He could hear frenzied shouts and blaster fire. An instant later, an explosion rocked the entire building, followed by several seconds of silence. Another round of blaster fire and shouting confirmed that Murtaugh's team had breached the entrance. Scourge leapt through the hatch leading into the warehouse's upper floor. There were no interior walls. It consisted of a single massive room. In the far corner, a staircase led down to the lower level. A row of mattresses ran along one wall, but the primary purpose of the space seemed to be storage. Crates and footlockers were scattered about, along with a haphazard collection of armor, weapons, and other military equipment. A computer terminal had been set up near the mattresses, along with four blank monitors that would once have shown the images from the security cams on the roof. Scourge registered all this without conscious thought. His primary focus was on the 20-odd humans struggling into their combat gear to join the battle downstairs. Unfortunately for them, that was never going to happen. Like a red wind, Scourge swept through their ranks, slashing left and right, hewing off limbs and decapitating bodies. Violent bursts of the force picked his victims up and tossed them around like rag dolls, breaking bones and shattering skulls. The Separatists offered virtually no resistance. They had been caught off guard. They hadn't expected an ambush from the roof. These were not soldiers. They were ordinary men and women who had received only the most basic training when they joined the cause. Scourge's savage and sudden assault and the bloody carnage he left in his wake sent them into a panic. He fed on their primal fears. Some he killed, others he left mortally wounded and writhing on the floor, their lives enduring for 30 or 40 agonizing seconds, while their high-pitched cries of pain fueled his bloodlust. Had the Separatists coordinated their efforts into a focused and organized counterattack, they might have been able to challenge him. But they just scattered, running for their lives. Scourge drank in their terror and confusion and felt the growing power of the dark side. He channeled that power and refocused it, sending it out in waves that rippled across the room, further inciting the panicked retreat of his enemies. When two women managed to resist the onslaught of fear and fight back, he was on them in an instant, cutting them down with a few quick slashes of his lightsaber. Everyone else was running. Some fled downstairs. Scourge let them go. They wouldn't get past Murtaugh's team. Others tried to hide, cowering behind crates and footlockers. But Scourge didn't need to see them to hunt them down. He could sense them through the force, trembling and sobbing silently, their minds numb with shock, and he stalked them one by one, breathing hard, not with exertion, but excitement. It was over in minutes. Only then, standing alone amid the bodies, did Scourge notice that the sounds of battle from below had ended. Moving quickly, he crossed the room and descended the staircase. The floor below was similar to the one above, except for a row of offices built along the east side of the building. There were no interior walls. The floor was stacked with crates and piled with supplies. Bodies were scattered everywhere. Most were Separatists, but Scourge noticed three or four wearing Nyriss's colors. The rest of Murtaugh's team were methodically searching the dead, looking for survivors to interrogate. Scourge shook his head, knowing it was a waste of time. The greatest fear of any Separatist organization was betrayal from within. Only the two or three top people would know anything useful, and they would never have allowed themselves to be taken alive. Confident that the building was secure, he deactivated his lightsaber and clipped it onto his belt. Then he activated the comlink on his wrist.
All clear, Murtaugh. Get Setchel in here.
We're already inside.
Murtaugh's voice came back to him.
Found the control center and some offices at the back.
Scourge had to clench his teeth to keep from screaming with rage. He had given specific orders, and Murtaugh and Setchel had willfully disobeyed them. He made his way toward the offices with long, purposeful strides. As he approached, his anger gave way to suspicion. There had to be a reason they had defied him. Were they simply undercutting his authority? Or was it something more sinister? Were they setting some kind of trap? As he drew near the offices, he saw both Setchel and Murtaugh huddled at a comm terminal. Surprisingly, there were no other members of Murtaugh's team nearby. Scourge approached cautiously, probing with the Force to see if he could detect any immediate threat. Neither turned as he approached. Their attention was focused entirely on the comm.
Are there any others?
Murtaugh was asking.
Nothing I can find, Setchel replied. But I might be able to...
I gave you two an order,
Scourge barked as he came up behind them. They both turned to face him. Murtaugh's lips were pressed tightly together, and he seemed to have gone pale. But Setchel seemed more amused than scared.
After you were gone, I realized a flaw in your plan,
he said with an ingratiating smile.
If the Separatists had anything incriminating here in the base, they'd probably try to destroy it before we could get our hands on it. I told Murtaugh I might be able to salvage something if he could get me inside, but the longer we waited, the less chance we'd have to recover anything useful.
Scourge didn't say anything, his eyes fixed on Setchel with a piercing glare.
We would have tried to contact you, but you'd already started the mission. We didn't want to distract you.
Do you take me for a fool?
Scourge asked softly, his hand casually falling to the hilt of his lightsaber. Setchel's smile faded, and Scourge caught a hint of fear in his eyes.
I don't normally disobey orders,
Murtaugh said, jumping in to try to defuse the situation.
But in this case, Setchel was right. Once the Separatists knew the battle was lost, they ran a cleanup program on their computers to erase all their data files. If we'd waited for your signal, everything would have been lost.
Scourge let the hand drop from his weapon. Now was not the time to settle this, but it was one more thing Setchel would answer for once he finally got a chance to speak with him alone.
What did you find?
A recording of a recent communication,
Setchel answered, pressing a button on the terminal. A ghostly blue three-dimensional image crackled into being, hovering a few centimeters above the holocom. The frozen image was slightly under a meter in height, a perfect miniature of the speaker.
Darth Cedrix, Scourge gasped.
Most of the call was already erased by the cleanup program, Setchel explained. But I was able to save this.
He hit another button, and the recording began to play. It was obviously damaged. The image flickered in and out of focus, and the audio was plagued by bursts of static that cut off much of what was said.
Our latest failed attempt,
Cedrix said, his voice thin and crackling.
Nyriss is dangerous and must not be... Legions is hidden. Stop the Emperor. This must end.
Can you get anything more? Scourge asked.
Not here, Setchel answered. Give me enough time and the proper equipment, and I should be able to come up with plenty.
Tell your team to load up every terminal and data file they find,
Scourge instructed Murtaugh.
Nyriss won't be pleased if we leave something important behind.
Setchel didn't say anything, but the grin on his face spoke volumes. Nyriss's personal slave greeted them at the front door as the three arrived back at the palace.
My mistress received your message, she said to Scourge. She wishes to speak to you at once.
Get started on those data files as soon as Murtaugh's team finishes unloading them, he said to Setchel.
Forgive me, my lord,
the young Twi'lek said, her voice trembling slightly.
Darth Nyriss wants to speak to all three of you.
Scourge glanced from the slave to Setchel and Murtaugh, wondering if they knew anything more than he did. They only shrugged.
Let's go,
Scourge said with a brisk nod. The Twi'lek turned and led them down the now familiar corridors to Darth Nyriss's personal chamber. As she always did, the slave knocked once on the door and waited for acknowledgement from within.
Enter,
Nyriss called. The slave opened the door and slipped to the side to allow Scourge, Murtaugh, and Setchel to crowd into the small room where Nyriss sat at her computer terminal, looking as if she hadn't moved since the last time Scourge had seen her there. She flicked off the terminal, spun in her chair, and stood up.
Is it true?
She asked, not even bothering to greet them.
Is Darth Zedrix a traitor to the Empire?
We found a recording of a call from him at the Separatist base, Setchel said. They were obviously working with him.
Despite the compelling evidence, Scourge wasn't fully convinced. Zedrix was human, which didn't sit well with some of the Sith pureblood families in the nobility of the Empire. Yet whatever petty prejudices he had endured in his life were insignificant compared with all he had achieved. Darth Zedrix was the longest-serving member of the Dark Council, having joined a full decade before Nyriss. He had risen to the penultimate position in the Empire, and while Scourge could understand his desire to eliminate Nyriss or other potential rivals, it was hard to imagine that he would be bold enough to challenge the immortal, all-powerful Emperor.
Zedrix's betrayal makes no sense, he said, feeling confident enough in his analysis of the situation to voice his opinion.
It makes perfect sense if you know the man as I do,
Nyriss assured him.
Zedrix is old and desperate. He knows his position has become vulnerable. Soon the Emperor will have no further use for him. In his arrogance, he thinks he can usurp the Emperor's position and save himself. That is why he plotted with the Separatists to assassinate me. He knows those of us currently on the Dark Council would oppose him in his bid for power. He seeks to replace us with new members who are weak and inexperienced. He thinks he will be able to manipulate them and seize control of the entire council so that they will follow him when he finally moves against the Emperor.
Her explanation made sense. He had seen firsthand how those in power became desperate when they sensed their positions were threatened.
It won't be long before Darth Zedrix learns of the attack on Bos Theerda,
Nyriss continued.
They must act quickly.
I'm surprised the Emperor instructed you to deal with this, Scourge remarked. I'd have expected him to order the Imperial Guard to arrest Zedrix.
The Emperor doesn't know,
Nyriss said.
Darth Zedrix has allied himself with Separatists, Scourge insisted. He's a traitor to the Empire. It is our duty to report him.
I don't think that would be the best plan,
Setchel cautioned, ignoring Scourge and addressing Nyriss directly.
We have little evidence, and your rivalry with Zedrix is well known. If we come forward with these accusations, he will simply deny them. The Emperor is unlikely to act without first gathering more proof. This will give Zedrix a chance to cover up his involvement or go into hiding.
Setchel is right, Nyriss said. The element of surprise is our greatest advantage. Zedrix doesn't know we have exposed his treachery. If we strike now, we can catch him unprepared.
It was obvious her mind was made up, and Scourge could follow the logic of her arguments, yet he still felt uncomfortable not reporting Zedrix to the Emperor.
An assault on his stronghold will be difficult, Murtaugh warned. We don't have the numbers to overwhelm his defenses, and I don't like hiring mercenaries for a job like this. Too much chance one of them will sell us out to Zedrix.
Perhaps assassination is the way to go,
Setchel suggested.
do to him what he tried to do to you.
We would need a particularly skilled and accomplished assassin, Nyriss said.
She looked at Scourge.
Do you think you could get close enough to Zedrix?
Scourge carefully considered all the variables before he replied. His first instinct was to propose an undercover operation, with him seeking a position on Zedrix's personal staff. Over several weeks, he could study the routines of his intended victim and all his servants, patiently waiting for a chance to catch him alone, unarmed and unprepared. But there were no Sith among Zedrix's followers. Many Sith were prejudiced against humans. No doubt the Dark Counselor would never allow Sith too close to him, fearing they might one day turn on him. Scourge might be able to find some other way to infiltrate Zedrix's inner circle, but as Nyriss had pointed out, they needed to act quickly. There wasn't time for a prolonged undercover mission.
Inside his stronghold, he is untouchable, he declared finally.
There may be a way to lure him out,
Setchel said.
The Separatists seem to use coded communications whenever they contact Zedrix. If I can replicate the code, I can send a message requesting an urgent meeting at some remote location.
An ambush might work, Murtagh agreed. Zedrix won't want to draw attention to his treachery. At most, he'll have two or three of his most trusted followers with him. With enough troops, we should be able to take him down.
No,
Nyriss said, shaking her wizened head.
Zedrix would sense it coming. Whoever we send, we'll have to hide his presence through the Force until Zedrix walks into the trap.
It was obvious whom she was referring to, but Scourge was still reluctant.
Asking me to kill a member of the Dark Council is not as simple as you make it sound.
I did not expect you to balk at this task,
Nyriss said.
He has committed treason. He brought this on himself.
You misunderstand, Scourge said, choosing his words carefully. The human traitor deserves to die, but he is a Dark Lord of the Sith. Alone, what chance will I have against him?
I should have known, Setchel said, grinning. You're afraid.
Fighting a battle I can't win isn't brave, Scourge shot back. It's stupid.
At least you have the courage to speak your mind, Nyriss said.
You already have enough sycophants,
Scourge replied, glaring at Setchel. Nyriss flashed one of her ghastly grins, sending a chill down Scourge's spine. Somehow he kept himself from shuddering.
I think the two of us should continue this conversation privately, she said.
Setchel and Murtagh bowed and left without a word. Scourge was pleased to see they were chastened by their sudden exclusion. Nyriss didn't speak until the Twi'lek servant had closed the door behind them.
You are right to be cautious, she said. But you underestimate your own abilities.
Scourge's thoughts jumped back to the slaughter at the Separatist warehouse. He remembered the energy and exhilaration he'd felt. He could sense his power was growing. His connection to the dark side had never been stronger. But butchering poorly prepared soldiers was not the same as facing highly trained Sith.
Zedrix won't come alone. He'll have me outnumbered.
Zedrix surrounds himself with acolytes of the dark side. Your talent will let you feed on their power and turn it against them. The greater your opponent's connection to the Force, the stronger you become.
Strong enough to kill a member of the Dark Council?
Against me, you would stand no chance,
Nyriss replied.
But Zedrix is old and infirm. And he is human. They are a lesser species. Over the decades, the dark side has exacted too great a toll on his body. He is a hollow shell of what he once was. He holds on to his current position only because of his cunning. His followers obey him without question. Too frightened of his reputation to see how age has ravaged his flesh and left him weak.
Nyriss paused, waiting for Scourge's response. He wasn't eager to offer one without carefully considering everything he had learned. He believed what Nyriss had told him about his own abilities. He'd felt the truth of it in his most recent battles. But he wasn't ready to trust her. If Zedrix really was as weak as she claimed, she wouldn't need Scourge's help to eliminate him. The truth was, Scourge wanted to kill Zedrix. It wasn't just his loyalty to the Emperor, though he firmly believed the only fit punishment for treason was death. He wanted to test himself against a member of the Dark Council. He wanted to prove to himself and to Nyriss that he was worthy of this task. If Darth Zedrix fell to his hand, his name would be hailed and feared throughout the Empire. Nyriss would be indebted to him for eliminating her rival, and the Emperor would reward him for executing a traitor. It was unlikely he would be chosen to replace Zedrix on the Dark Council. Scourge was still too young, too unknown. He hadn't forged the necessary political alliances or built up a cadre of servants and followers. Yet this would be a bold first step. It would make his name known in the halls of power. And when another vacancy opened up on the council down the road, in 5 years or maybe 10, he would be the leading candidate.
"Tell Setchel to set up the meeting," he said.
Nyriss smiled again, but this time Scourge didn't feel it so unnerving. Instead, he found himself wondering if it would be her he replaced when he finally ascended to his rightful position. Chapter 9. Revan stared at the flickering topographic map of Rekiad on the Ebon Hawk's navigation screens. The glacier-covered world had never been settled. No cities or villages dotted the screen. The scans revealed nothing but a frozen wasteland of ice and snow, stretching off for hundreds of kilometers in every direction. According to Candorus, the Mandalorians had set up a temporary landing field somewhere on the planet's surface. The clans that had gathered on Rekiad worked together to maintain and protect the vessels there. It was effectively neutral ground. Outside the landing field, however, each clan laid claim to its own territory, a claim they were willing to fight to defend. Neither Revan nor Candorus thought it was wise to take the Ebon Hawk to the communal landing strip. Outsiders weren't welcome among the Mandalorians. Candorus figured they'd have better luck dealing directly with Clan Ordo, his own people. The original plan was to land within walking distance of Clan Ordo's base camp and approach on foot. Using spaceports was rarely a preferred option for the kind of smugglers and miscreants who owned the Ebon Hawk throughout its history, and many had installed customized upgrades to allow the ship to land in less than ideal conditions. But Revan doubted they had ever intended to visit a world as inhospitable as Rekiad, and he was starting to have second thoughts. Gale force winds hammered the ship's hull, causing it to buck and lurch, and a blizzard of swirling snow and ice limited the range of the Hawk's sensors. To get close enough for the topographic scan, Revan had to bring them in only a few hundred meters above the surface of the world. Close enough that one wrong move could send them crashing into the surface. T3 beeped anxiously at Revan's side, crowding the pilot's chair as Revan fought to keep the ship level.
"Get Candorus up here," Revan barked. "Tell him to check those grid coordinates again."
The little astromech droid spun around and sped off in search of the third member of their crew. A gust of wind caused the ship to veer down and to the left. The safety restraints bit into Revan's flesh as he jammed the throttle forward and yanked back on the stick, pulling the ship up out of a steep dive moments before it hit the ground. The ship veered off course, and suddenly a massive glacier jutting up from the planet's frozen surface materialized on the nav display. Revan banked hard to avoid plowing into the wall of ice, but even the lightning-fast reactions of a Jedi couldn't entirely overcome the Hawk's momentum. The ship was spared a direct hit, but its underside clipped a sharp outcropping of ice. The impact sent the Hawk into a spiraling, twisting roll. Revan wrenched the stick from side to side, fighting for control. Using the Force, he was able to anticipate and react to the erratic flight with instantaneous precision adjustments, keeping the ship aloft until it regained its equilibrium. The immediate crisis averted, Revan took the Hawk up to a safer altitude and set the autopilot. Then he slumped in his chair and let out a long, low sigh. After a few seconds, he straightened up, readjusted his restraint belts, and checked the instrument panel. A blinking red warning light confirmed his fears. The impact with the glacier had damaged the landing gear. Revan muttered a curse under his breath, just as a much louder string of profanity came from Candorus staggering into the cockpit. T3 rolled in after him, beeping indignantly.
"You trying to smash us into green pulp back there?"
Candorus grumbled, plopping down into the co-pilot seat.
"I thought you knew how to fly this rusted slag heap."
"I thought you said Clan Ordo had set up camp somewhere on this frozen rock," Revan shot back. "Couldn't see a blasted thing on those grid coordinates you gave me."
"Maybe they moved to another location," Candorus said with a shrug. "Can't have gone too far, though. Not in these conditions. Do a ground scan of the area and they'll probably turn up."
"That's what I was doing,"
Revan replied through gritted teeth.
"Turns out it's a good way to get up close and personal with a glacier."
Candorus glanced over at the warning light.
"That why that red light's blinking?"
"The landing gear got smashed up when we clipped the glacier."
"You couldn't just fly around it?"
Revan rolled his eyes.
"Go down for another look,"
Candorus advised after a few moments of strained silence.
"Clan Ordo's gotta be close by."
"Even if we find them, then what? You really expect me to bring the ship in on a busted landing gear?"
"You're a smart guy,"
Candorus answered, shifting to get comfortable in his seat.
"You'll think of something."
There wasn't much point in continuing the argument, so Revan let it drop. Yet he couldn't help but wonder at the recent change he'd noticed in Candorus. As long as he'd known the Mandalorian, he'd sensed an underlying tension in him. Like a soldier in enemy territory, he was always ready for a fight. As a Mandalorian, he was never fully accepted by those in the Republic, and he knew it. Now, however, he seemed different. He was still gruff and taciturn, but ever since they'd left Coruscant, he'd been less grim, more relaxed. He was eager to be back among his own people, and he wasn't about to let a few minor setbacks like a missing camp or damaged landing gear stop him. To be fair, Revan had no intention of abandoning their quest either. There was too much at stake to turn back. Which meant Candorus was right. The only real option was to keep looking for Clan Ordo's camp and hope they got lucky. Revan brought the Hawk in low again, but this time he throttled it back to half speed. The swirling wind still made for a rough ride, but at least he'd have more time to react if something went wrong.
"See if you can do something to give our sensors a boost," he said to T3.
The little astromech chirped with pleasure and extended a small probe from a panel in his side to interface directly with the Hawk's systems. While T3 worked, Revan began a standard search pattern with the original coordinates for the camp at the center. Taking the Hawk around in ever-widening circles, he spiraled outward, letting the sensors scan the ground for signs of life. Suddenly, T3 began beeping excitedly. Candorus leaned forward to look at the scanner's display.
"I think your droid's got some rust on the brain," he said. "I don't see anything."
Revan knew better than to doubt the little astromech.
"Can you enhance the image?" he asked T3.
T3 responded with a low whistle, and a second later, a static-filled thermal image appeared on the screen. The details were difficult to make out, but it appeared to be a small collection of tents and temporary shelters built against the leeward side of a small mountain of ice and snow.
"Could be them,"
Candorus admitted. reaching out one of his massive hands to give T3 a friendly pat on the head. The droid squawked in indignant protest, and he quickly pulled his hand back.
Doesn't look like there's a landing strip at the camp, Revan noted. See any place for us to touch down?
The display zoomed out as T3 adjusted the Hawk's scanners to pan rapidly back and forth across the snow. A few seconds later, they zoomed in again.
Perfect, Revan said with a smile. Nice work, T3.
That's not a landing strip, Candorous cautioned. It's a giant snowdrift.
With the landing gear shot, we're going to need something to cushion the blow when we hit the ground.
You really think this'll work?
Sure, Revan replied. But you'd better strap yourself in just in case.
Candorous scrambled to lock in his safety belt as Revan sent the Hawk into its descent. T3 scooted across the cockpit to the metal braces anchored to the floor and locked his wheels in with a metallic thunk. Fighting wind and gravity, Revan struggled to keep the damaged ship level as he took it down. Seconds before they touched ground, a blast of wind grabbed the Ebon Hawk and pitched it hard to starboard. Revan jammed the stick to port, desperately trying to keep the ship from flipping over. It slammed into the snowbank at a 45-degree angle, carving a 50-meter-long trench in the powder before finally coming to rest. Looking through the small cockpit window, Revan could see nothing but blue-white flakes. The entire front half of the ship was buried in the drift. But the sensors indicated that, apart from the already damaged landing gear, the Hawk had survived relatively unscathed. More important, so had its passengers. Revan carefully unbuckled his safety belt, knowing he would have bruises where the straps had dug into him during the collision. Beside him, Candorous was doing the same. T3 simply unlocked his wheels from the braces and rolled free.
I guess sometimes it's not so bad being a droid,
Candorous groaned as he stood up, rubbing his right shoulder with his left hand.
You mean like when you're marching through a blizzard?
Revan asked.
This snowdrift's at least 5 kilometers from the campsite. Candorous only grunted in reply.
While the big Mandalorian gathered the gear and supplies for their trek from the cargo hold, Revan and T3 ran diagnostics on the Hawk to determine the full extent of the damage.
Doesn't look too bad, Revan commented when they were done. Think you can fix it up while we head off to the camp?
T3 beeped twice.
It's going to be hard for you to keep up out there in the snow, Revan reminded him. Besides, someone has to stay and guard the ship.
The astromech reluctantly whistled his consent.
You get started on repairs. I'll go give Candorous a hand.
It took them almost an hour before they were ready to venture out into the frigid wasteland. They were bundled up head to toe in thick winter garb, snow pants, hooded jackets, scarves, goggles, heavy boots, and fur-lined gloves, all of it white to provide camouflage in case they ran into trouble. Candorous had armed himself with a heavy repeating blaster carbine. He offered a similar weapon to Revan, but the Jedi shook his head.
You don't want to be swinging that lightsaber around when we get to the camp, Candorous said. Jedi aren't too popular out here.
Revan frowned, then nodded. He knew Candorous had a point, but he didn't relish the idea of lugging the massive gun along. He picked up a pair of blaster pistols.
I'll get by with these, he said, sliding them into the straps on either hip.
Suit yourself,
Candorous said with a shrug. Then he added,
when we get to the camp, let me do the talking. Remember, these are my people.
I can live with that,
Revan said, hitting the switch to lower the cargo hold's loading ramp.
But if we're going to get there before dark, we'd better get moving.
They maneuvered the hover sled they had loaded up with supplies down the ramp and out into the raging blizzard. The howling wind threatened to knock them off their feet and made conversation almost impossible. The swirling snow almost blinded them, but Revan had entered the camp's coordinates on a portable locator to keep them on track, and he used hand gestures to communicate their route to Candorous.
The heavy layers of clothing made the sub-zero conditions bearable. The hard labor of trudging through the snow over uneven terrain helped warm them up, too. After almost 2 hours of slow progress, Revan saw the dim outline of a small mountain ahead of them. He signaled to Candorus, indicating that the camp was on the other side. The Mandalorian nodded and signaled back that they needed to step up the pace. Revan nodded his agreement. The light around them was fading as Rekiad's sun, invisible through the storm, slowly set. The last thing they needed was to have to press on in total darkness. As they skirted the base of the mountain and reached the leeward side, the wind died to almost nothing. It wasn't long before they could see the soft glow of lights from the camp. Gradually more details of the camp came into view. There were roughly a dozen small tents set up only a few meters away from a sheer wall of ice at the mountain's base. Set away from the tents was a roughly constructed shack. Revan noticed a pair of generators hooked up to it, no doubt to provide power and heat, and he guessed it doubled as a meeting room and a supply center for any stores that would suffer if left out in the cold. Several sleds were scattered among the tents, some laden with supplies, others empty. On the far side of the camp were four large tarp-covered mounds. Revan's heart sank. As part of the terms of the surrender, he'd ordered the Mandalorians to disassemble their infamous basilisk war droids, great metal beasts the Mandalorians often rode into combat. Judging by the size of the covered objects, and by whatever hints of shape weren't obscured by the tarps, some of the defeated had chosen to ignore his decree.
"One more step and we paint the snow with your brains!"
a voice shouted out. Four sentries rose up into view from behind the drifts, two on either side of Revan and Candorus. Dressed in heavy cold-weather clothes of mostly blues, golds, and browns, they were armed with blaster rifles, which they had carefully trained on the interlopers.
"Lay your weapons down and identify yourselves!"
The speaker, a male, was the sentry closest to Revan on his left. Out of the corner of his eye, the Jedi could see that Candorus was holding his ground, careful to avoid any sudden movement, but not making any effort to obey the order. Revan decided the smart thing to do would be to follow his lead.
"My name is Candorus of Clan Ordo,"
the big man shouted,
"and I don't lay down my weapons for anyone."
From the stunned silence, it was clear his name had gotten their attention.
"How do we know you are really Candorus?"
one of the other sentries demanded. This was also a man's voice, deeper than the first.
"Well, Edric," Candorus replied, "I could punch you in the face until I straightened out that crooked beak of yours, but we'd probably all freeze to death before I finished."
The sentry barked out a laugh, slung his gun over his shoulder, threw his arms wide, and ran to enclose Candorus in a fierce hug.
"Ha ha ha! It's good to see you again, brother!"
he shouted. Revan was relieved to see that the other sentries had also lowered their weapons. They came forward to form a tight circle around Candorus as they clasped his hands, slapped him on the back, and offered loud traditional greetings in Mandoa. After a few minutes, the one Candorus called Edric spoke up again.
"Let's get you and your friend out of the cold," he said in Basic. "Leave your sled. We'll have someone else come get it."
The other three sentries stayed at their post as Edric led Revan and Candorus through the camp toward the supply shack in the center. As they passed the tents, heads poked out to see what was happening. Shortly, a small crowd had grown in the newcomers' wake. Revan could hear a buzz of excitement building, but his Mandoa was too rusty, and he couldn't pick out what was being said. At the door of the building, Edric stamped his boots clear of snow before going inside. His guests did the same. The first thing Revan noticed was the warmth. His goggles fogged up, and he was only too happy to remove them to get a better view of the surroundings. As he had suspected, the shack served as both supply hut and meeting room. There were 7 or 8 Mandalorians already inside the building, lounging among the crates and packages, using them as makeshift furniture. In one corner was a massive pile of coats, scarves, and gloves. Edric was already stripping off his cold weather gear and tossing it on the pile. Revan quickly and gratefully followed suit. Candorous didn't have a chance to do the same. The instant he removed his goggles and unzipped his hood to expose his face, he was swarmed. Another round of traditional Mandua greetings rose up from the well-wishers, and Revan couldn't help but notice the pure joy on his friend's face as he was reunited with the other members of his clan. One of the things Revan had always admired about the Mandalorians, even as he'd fought them, was their loyalty. The ties that held a clan together went beyond friendship and even family. It was an essential part of the culture, ingrained in children from the day they were born or adopted into the clan. Not wanting to detract from the moment, he stood a respectful distance away. He was just beginning to wonder how much longer the celebratory reception would continue when the door swung open, and a tall, broad-shouldered figure forced its way into the room. The door slammed shut, and everything went silent. Nobody spoke as the figure peeled away the layers of clothing, revealing the face of an attractive woman. She had olive skin, and her straight, shoulder-length black hair was streaked with purple and red highlights. Her high, sharp cheekbones were tattooed with intricate blue swirls. Her eyes were also blue, but so pale they looked like shards of ice. Unlike everyone else they had come across, she didn't rush over to greet Candorous. Instead, she glared at him without saying a word.
"Sukuigar, Candorous,"
she finally said. It was a common Mandalorian greeting, but something about the way she said it made Revan think the literal translation of the words, "so you're still alive," was closer to her true intent.
"Sukuigar, Vila,"
he replied softly. She took a step toward him, then snapped her head to the side to stare at Revan. She was tall enough to look him in the eye. Without looking back at Candorous, she asked him in Mandoa,
"Do you want me to speak basic so the outsider can understand us?"
"I understand well enough,"
Revan replied in her native tongue. Vila arched her eyebrow in mild surprise, then turned her attention back to Candorous.
"What are you doing here?"
"Is that any way to greet a clan brother?"
Candorous asked.
"Are you still my clan brother? You left us after the war. You deserted Clan Ordo to become a mercenary."
"There was no Clan Ordo after the war,"
Candorous snapped back at her.
"Tigris was dead. We had no leader. We were scattered, broken, defeated. I wasn't the one who left."
"We heard you were working for the Jedi,"
Vila said, her voice low and hateful. In the silence that followed, the sentry called Edric spoke up.
"Sinvatine,"
he said, and there was a general murmur of agreement from the others in the room. The literal translation of the phrase was "driven snow," appropriate given the conditions outside. But Revan knew the true meaning of the phrase was closer to "the past is in the past." The Mandalorians believed that once you took up arms and armor of the clan, your past was irrelevant. Edric was saying that whatever Candorous had done over the past few years was irrelevant now that he had returned. From Vila's expression, it was difficult to tell if she agreed with him. But she let the matter of Candorous's past drop.
"I'm the leader of this clan now," she insisted. "I still have a right to know why you're here."
"To help Clan Ordo find Mandalore's mask."
Vila tilted her head to the side, as if getting a different angle might help her see whether Candorous was being completely honest with her.
"And what about this outsider?"
she asked, pointing to Revan.
"He's my friend. My brother. He will help us in our search."
"Do you have a name, outsider?"
Vila asked.
"His name is Avner,"
Candorous said, cutting Revan off.
He's a mercenary. We met while I was working for David Kang.
You can't speak for yourself?
She asked, still focused on Revan.
I thought you understood Mandoa. Am I going too fast for you?
I understand, Revan answered. You speak well. There was a gasp from the crowd, followed by the sound of stifled, nervous laughter. Revan knew full well the insult he had given. The Mandalorians were warriors. They had nothing but contempt for diplomats and politicians. They valued actions over words, and he just implied that Vila was all talk.
Brother Kendra is vouched for you. Say you can stay,
Vila said through clenched teeth.
But if you betray us, I'll kill you. If your weakness causes one of my people to get hurt, I'll kill you. If you slow us down, I'll kill you. Is that clear?
Wait, what was the second one again? Maybe I should write this down. There was another round of stifled laughter. Vila pretended not to hear it as she turned back to Candorus.
Welcome home, brother,
she said flatly. She grabbed her winter gear, quickly threw it back on, and left without saying another word. Once she was gone, the others in the room seemed to relax. Revan motioned to Candorus, calling him over to join him in the corner before he was swallowed up in a crowd of old friends.
Avner,
he whispered in Basic.
That's the best name you could come up with?
What's wrong with Avner?
You just rearranged the letters in Revan.
Relax. Nobody out here is going to...
Candorus stopped abruptly as he noticed Edric ambling toward them.
Don't judge Vila too harshly,
the sentry said, misinterpreting their hushed dialogue.
She's a good leader, but she has a temper.
He looked at Revan.
You should remember that next time you provoke her.
I just got caught in the middle, Revan protested. Candorus is the one she's really mad at. I get the sense you two have a history.
You could say that,
the big man admitted.
She's my wife.
Chapter 10.
Scourge had been waiting inside the cave on Bos Thirda for nearly an hour when he finally heard the faint sound of a speeder landing outside. A few minutes later, he heard footsteps coming down the passage. He smiled. Unlike his previous missions for Nyriss, this time he was not plagued with doubts and uncertainties. The anticipation of the coming kill kept him well focused on the task at hand. As expected, Darth Zedrix hadn't come alone. A pair of Sith acolytes, humans, one male, one female, preceded him, striding into the cave, lightsabers drawn. They wore light armor under robes of blue and gold, the colors of their liege. The circular cavern was only 10 meters in diameter and dark. The only illumination came from their blades and the glowing fungus that clung to the rough rock walls. Scourge crouched in the shadows, wrapped in a cloak of the dark side that both made him invisible to the Force and helped to ward off the chill of the subterranean air. He remained motionless as the pair passed within a few meters of his hiding place, patiently waiting. Darth Zedrix trailed his escort by several paces. Unlike his acolytes, he had not drawn his weapon, and he wore no visible armor beneath his robes. He was several centimeters taller than Scourge, but much thinner. He had thick, shoulder-length white hair, but no beard. His face was lined, though not as extensively or deeply as Nyriss's, and there was a hint of a stoop to his shoulders and a cautious frailty about the way he moved. His appearance recalled Nyriss's words.
He is human. They are a lesser species. Over the decades, the dark side has exacted too great a toll on his body. He is a hollow shell of what he once was.
Yet Scourge could sense the Counselor's enormous power. Darth Zedrix was still a member of the Dark Council. and underestimating him would be a fatal mistake.
The moment the tall human passed Scourge's hiding place, Scourge leapt, igniting his lightsaber as he flew through the air. For a moment, he thought his first strike would find its mark, and he was almost disappointed at the thought of ending Zedrix's life so easily. But at the last instant, the human's own blade materialized, seemingly out of nowhere, to intercept the blow. They exchanged a quick flurry of thrusts and parries. Scourge tried and failed to draw on his foe's fear and anger. Zedrix was too controlled, and it felt more like fighting a droid. Scourge forcibly thrust his own fears away and reached deep inside himself to find the fury he needed. He had maneuvered himself so that he was behind Zedrix, blocking the passage that was the only route into and out of the cave. The two acolytes had already spun around and rushed in to join the fray, and he prepared himself to deal with them too. But suddenly, he had only those two to deal with, as Zedrix backed away. He seemed to be more obsessed with preserving his own life than killing his enemy, a weakness that left him content to let his two underlings face this unknown foe while he stayed at a safe distance. The two apprentices launched themselves at Scourge, unleashing their rage as they drew on the power of the dark side, unaware that their anger was feeding their opponent as well. The female came in high, her lightsaber slashing at Scourge's head. At the same time, the human male came in low, looking to chop at his enemy's legs. Scourge ducked under the woman's blows, spinning to the side as he parried the lightsaber at his knees. The pair came at him again, once more coordinating their attacks, this time trying to flank him on either side. Scourge lunged forward, splitting the attack by diving into a forward roll that took him between his two opponents. For an instant, he was vulnerable. One quick cut from either foe could have ended his life. But they were inexperienced, and they hadn't expected him to move toward them. By the time the woman reacted with a backhand swipe of her weapon, the moment had been lost. The lightsaber hummed by his cheek as he tumbled between them, but he emerged unscathed. The man was slower to react. By the time Scourge was back on his feet, the acolyte was only just starting to turn around. The Sith Lord delivered a quick kick to the back of the man's knee. The man pinwheeled his arms as he fought to regain his balance. Scourge saw the opening and delivered what would have been a lethal blow had the woman not thrown herself between them and parried the blow. Her move was reckless and foolhardy, but Scourge hadn't been expecting it, and her impulsive reaction saved her companion. It also exposed her weakness. The female was the more dangerous opponent, but she obviously cared for her partner. She was willing to put herself in harm's way to defend him, a flaw Scourge could easily exploit. He abruptly changed tactics, shifting from the conventional defensive positions of the Sorasu form to the acrobatic attack sequences of Ataru. Taking two quick steps to gain speed, Scourge leapt at the nearby cavern wall, planted both feet on its vertical surface, then pushed off hard to launch himself into a spinning flip over the man's head. His opponent tried to turn and pivot to keep Scourge in front of him, but the furious burst of action was too fast for his lightsaber to track. He was late bringing his blade up to protect his head, once again exposing himself to a lethal strike. This time, when the woman moved in to protect her partner, Scourge was ready. He had purposefully directed his leap so that he came in at a sharper angle than necessary, leaving barely enough room for the female to come between him and his supposed target. When Scourge suddenly redirected his blade mid-leap to strike at her instead, she instinctively stepped back to absorb the impact with her own weapon. But with her partner crowded directly behind her, there was no room. Their bodies collided, and their feet tangled together, sending both of them crashing awkwardly to the ground. Scourge landed beside their prone forms. He brought his heavy boot crashing down on his fallen foe's face, relishing the wet crunch of cartilage and bone beneath his heel. Her body spasmed, the muscles locked in the seizures of her death throes. The man had scrambled to his feet, but instead of throwing himself at Scourge, he only stared at the woman's twitching corpse. Scourge could taste his horror and fear. They gave him a fresh burst of energy. He lashed out with the force, striking the man in the chest hard enough to send him stumbling backward several steps into the cavern wall. The man struck the rough-hewn rock hard enough to knock the lightsaber from his hand, leaving him unarmed. With a casual flick of his wrist, Scourge sent his own lightsaber spiraling toward his defenseless foe.
At the last second, the man threw up his hands in a vain effort to protect himself, but the glowing blade easily sliced through his palms and throat before ricocheting back to Scourge's waiting grasp. As the human's corpse crumpled to the ground, Scourge was already turning to face his last remaining foe. Darth Zedrix was standing motionless in the center of the cavern, watching the action with a cool, detached reserve. His lightsaber was still drawn, but he held it casually at his side. The blade pointed toward the floor.
"I know you,"
he said, his voice echoing off the chamber's stone walls.
"Nyriss's new pet, Lord Scourge."
He wrinkled his features in distaste.
"Why do you purebloods always choose such ludicrous names for yourselves? Do you think it's intimidating?"
Scourge didn't reply. Instead, he raised his blade and began a slow, cautious advance. Zedrix laughed.
"Are you really that stupid, Scourge? Has Nyriss actually convinced you that you have the strength to stand against a member of the Dark Council? Has she promised you riches and power if you defeat me?"
"She didn't need to promise me anything," Scourge answered. "You're a traitor to the Empire. It is my honor and duty to kill you."
"Ah, now I understand,"
Zedrix said with a smile, twirling his lightsaber at his side.
"She played on your loyalty to our glorious Emperor. How quaint."
Scourge stopped, suddenly aware that he didn't feel any fear emanating from his foe. There was no anger either. He didn't get any sense of emotion coming from Darth Zedrix at all, and he realized the old man was consciously shielding himself from Scourge's awareness. Scourge concentrated his focus, reaching out with the Force to pierce the veil Zedrix had wrapped around himself, only to find nothing but a swirling maelstrom of dark side energy. Scourge broke into a run, charging at his enemy the instant he understood the nature of the trap. Zedrix had kept him talking while he gathered his power for a single lethal attack. Zedrix raised his left hand and unleashed his power in a storm of purple lightning. Scourge instinctively used the Force to throw up an invisible barrier to shield himself. The bolts arced through the air, rippling through the shield to engulf Scourge in electric agony. He screamed, his voice rising above the hiss and crackle of the fiery energy coursing through his veins. Every nerve in his body exploded in excruciating pain as the lightning seared his flesh, cooking him in his own armor. He fell to the floor, curled into himself. His skin blistered and burned. The whole thing had taken only a few seconds.
"You didn't realize Nyriss sent you here to die, did you?"
Zedrix mocked.
"She never expected you to kill me. You're nothing but a message, a warning."
Ignoring the terrible pain, Scourge somehow forced himself to his feet. Zedrix raised an eyebrow in mild surprise.
"Is that what you call the attempts on her life?"
Scourge gasped.
"A warning?"
Zedrix laughed again.
"You think I'm the one who hired those inept assassins? Nyriss has you twisted in knots. She's using you for a game far beyond anything you can imagine."
Scourge shook his head, trying as much to shake off the residual effects of the lightning as to deny Zedrix's words.
"You feel your strength returning, do you?"
Zedrix observed.
"Think carefully before you challenge me again. I might not let you live next time."
"Why did you let me live?"
Scourge wanted to know.
"You have potential,"
Zedrix said.
"And thanks to you, I have need of some new apprentices. I could find a use for someone with your talents."
"You want me to betray Nyriss?"
"What do you owe her?"
Zedrix demanded.
"She used you. She sent you here to die just to make a point.
Scourge didn't answer. Instead, he was thinking back on everything that had happened since he'd first entered Nyriss's service. Nyriss had admitted to hiring the mercenaries to test him, but even after that, he'd still suspected Setchel of plotting to kill him. Had the conniving advisor merely been following Nyriss's orders?